This programming is sponsored by Crew listeners and the generous support of Fairfield Glass, located at 2705 West Briggs. Specializing in all types of business and residential glasswork and repair, including mirrors, insulated units, shower stall installations, and auto glass replacement. For more information, the number is 641-472-2173. That's Fairfield Glass, serving the Fairfield community since 1952.
KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Grassroots, community-supported, solar-powered
yes.
radio. Broadcasting live from the Cultural District here in sunny Fairfield, Iowa. With
beautiful day.
With our solar panels working overtime.
Yes, beautiful yeah. day.
And
beautiful.
This is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my mom and co-host Caroline Kilborn.
Good afternoon, everyone, or if you're listening on Monday, good morning.
Absolutely, yes. If anyone who misses this on Fridays at 1 p.m. misses us, they can catch us at Monday morning, 8 a.m., or online from the archives at any time. The beauty of the internet. When you started doing radio, they didn't have the...
Oh, no.
No, so no. Did you ever get to listen to your the shows that you had done again?
Well, once in a while I had to tape when not, you know, we were going to be gone or something. I tape. Mm-hmm. I used to tape a week ahead sometimes.
Right.
And
but the live shows, it was like once and done.
Once and done, yeah.
And that was it.
Yep.
Wow. Well, the world has changed, and the world is continuing to change and will be changing into the future.
Yes.
But hopefully not quite in the way that our guest is today is envisioning. So... You want to introduce our guest, Mom?
Yes, I do. Today we have with us DJ McHale, and he is the author of the best-selling book series Pendragon, Journal of Adventure Through Time and Space, the spooky Morpheus Road Trilogy, and the whimsical picture book The Monster Princess. He has written, directed, and produced numerous award-winning television series and movies for young people, including Are You Afraid of the Dark?, Flight 29 Down, and Tower of Terror. He lives with his family in Southern California. And on the back of this book, I'm holding my hand, the Michael Grant, New York Times best-selling author of the Gone series, says of this book, Silo, "You will have your pulse racing and your head spinning. Make plans to stay up all night finishing it." It's true.
Welcome to Writer's Voices, DJ.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
And the title of your new book is Silo, S-Y-L-O.
Yes, and I'm not going to tell you what that stands for.
Yeah, come on.
All right, secret something. Secret, am I right? Is the S secret?
Oh, no. I'm hoping that some people will pick the book up. I hope most people pick it up because they like adventure stories and that kind of thing. But I hope some people pick it up just because they want to know what the heck Silo stands for.
Right, that's true. Yeah, that's true.
So this is the first of a trilogy, correct?
Yes, it is a, I guess it could be characterized as science fiction. I write adventure stories, and this is no different. But it kind of skews more towards science fiction, but it's also a mystery, and it's a thriller, and it's the first of three. The second one will be out in March, and then I'm writing the third one right now, so I have no idea when that's going to be out.
But you do know how it ends, right?
that's a good question. Yes, generally speaking, I do know how it's going to end, but this is a little too much information, but developments yesterday as I'm writing the story, I'm thinking, you know, maybe I could end it slightly differently. So I'm not 100% sure where it's going to end yet.
Okay, all right.
Find out together, I guess.
Well, in Writer's Voices, we talk about what you've written, but we also talk a lot about the writing process with our guests. And so I'm really curious, when you set out to write the first book, did you know that it was planned as a trilogy from the beginning, and was the kind of the entire story arc, did you have it all in mind up front, or did
to a certain extent, yes, I do have it in mind, and the reason is part of it is just the way I work, but also it's the nature of the beast, I think, because I write stories that, besides being, you know, character driven, they're also very intricately plotted, and as we just talked about before, I kind of have to know where it's all going, because I want to know where a story is going to end before I can decide where it's going to begin. Mm. And the reason I do that is because it's so intricately plotted, I don't want to just kind of sit down and start typing once upon a time and just kind of let the story take me where it goes, because there's always a fantastical element, and then I'm making up new rules and whatnot, and I don't want to be writing for 3 months and then hit a dead end because there's some critical flaw in my concept that's not going to work. And even worse, I don't want to have a book published and then find the critical flaw in the next book and it's too late to go back and change it. So I kind of generally kind of outline the whole thing and know where it's going to go. However, given what I just told you, as much as I had planned out where it's going to end, in writing a particular scene yesterday in the third book, there were new possibilities that opened up, and I thought, wow, maybe I should go in this direction. I plan on going left. Maybe I should go right here. So as much as I plot it all out, I'm also way open to changing it as I go along. So I get kind of the best of both worlds.
And some authors work strictly one way, some strictly the others. You hear people talk about, they start with a character, and then whatever the character just does what they do, and they don't know what they're going to do. What the author doesn't know what the character is going to do until they get into that situation.
Well, I think that's.
But I think I would find that personally, that would be hard for me.
Me
to
too.
Write that
yeah.
way.
Yeah,
that's crazy. It's worse than hard.
Yeah.
And I think those authors, and believe me, I'm on panels all the time when I speak to authors, and I say how I kind of plot out my books. They look at me aghast, like, how could you possibly do that?
Yeah, well, we've had a lot of them tell us that they don't know how it's going to end until they get there. But I'll tell you, when I didn't realize this was a trilogy, okay? So I get to the end, I'm going, what?
Yeah, it is a bit of a cliffhanger.
Well, but all my books, they always have a climax. Even with Pendragon, I had 10 books, and there were 10 climaxes, but there were 9 climaxes. But then there's always that next chapter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Kind of is, it's the tee-up for the next book.
Right.
So you get that feeling of catharsis of, okay, success. Uh-oh, wait a minute. There's something more coming up.
Come on.
That happens with Silo. So in order to do that, you kind of have to know where it's going to go.
Right.
Yeah, the author does. Well, you really... The reader really wants to know where this is going to go, believe me.
Speaking from personal experience.
Yes.
Well, one of the things I love to do with my writing is I like to write for people who like to read. And that sounds silly, but if you like to read, it means you've read a lot of books and you've read a lot of stories like this. So what I like to do is take a reader down the garden path. I want them to think that they know exactly where the story is going to go. Oh, they're reading along and they're thinking, okay, what's this about? Okay, fine. Didn't see that coming. Okay, big surprise. Okay, fine. But then, just when they think they know where it's going to go, I take a right-hand turn. So they're reading along and thinking, okay, this is good. Whoa, wait a minute. we're going there? Oh, okay, let's go there for a while. And then, whoa, wait a minute, we're taking another left-hander. Whoa, holy mackerel. So you never really know where it's going to go. So I like to keep readers on their toes and guessing what they think is going to happen.
Yeah, well, this definitely does that. It was It was very enjoyable.
Now, DJ, one of the things that I noticed about this book is that your hero is a very ordinary guy. Is this common for you, that you take just sort of your average Joe and make him a hero? And why do you do that?
Well, I do it for a couple of reasons. One is I don't necessarily like to write. I mean, I think all my characters are special in some way, but they may not have any special powers or abilities that go beyond what the reader might have. I like to put the reader in the driver's seat. I like the reader to be experiencing the adventure along with the main character, so they can imagine what they can see themselves in that character, and they can imagine what they would do in that situation. And most readers don't have magic wands.
Right.
Most readers can't fly. Most readers aren't vampires.
Readers
are regular people. So what I do is I try to write stories about interesting characters that we would be interested in their story even if they didn't get involved with the big fantastical thing that the story's about. So, I mean, for years I made a TV show called Are You Afraid of the Dark? It was on Nickelodeon, and it was a spooky show for kids. It was kind of like Twilight Zone for kids. Mm-hmm. And each episode was a different cast, different story, a whole different ballgame. And writers would pitch me stories, and they'd say, I'd say, okay, what's your story idea? And they'd say something like, here, I'll make this up. Oh, I've got this great story idea about a swimming vampire. I'd say, okay, that's good. Who are the kids? Because it was always about kids.
Yeah.
And they'd say, I don't know, a couple of kids. Anyway, the swimming vampire can hold its breath for a long time, and it comes up under ships. I'm like, okay, that's kind of cool, but who are the kids? And inevitably they'd say, well, who cares? I'm like, no. I want a story about a couple of kids that I care about, that I want to know what happens to them, even if they never meet a swimming vampire. Because then when they meet the swimming vampire, then we're really with them. Then we care. So that's what I try to do with my characters. All my protagonists, whether it's Bobby Pendragon or Marshall Seaver or now Tucker Pierce, they're all kind of different versions of me. And in Tucker Pierce's case, I kind of tap into my slacker side.
He doesn't show a lot of ambition.
That's exactly it. He characterizes himself as a solid B-minus student. And as he says, and in my book, that's okay. Unfortunately, my parents have a different book.
Yeah.
And they're always telling him, you're not living up to your potential. You're not. If only you applied yourself. And if I had a nickel for every time I heard that when I was a kid, I would have a lot of nickels. So I think kids can relate to that. Not all kids are super achievers. Most kids are just kind of like moving along. So I wanted to make Tucker this guy who's really, really happy with his life, and in some ways he's very strong about it. He's mm-hmm. very confident. He's confident in his mediocrity. He doesn't want to live up to anyone's expectations. He's happy with who he is. Now he has friends who all have these great visions of, they live on an island, this wonderful island. They want to leave the island and make their way in the world, do these wonderful things. And Tucker's kind of happy living there. But ultimately it becomes a story about how you're not always able to do that. You can't.
Well, he gets that blow when he realizes his parents are not who he thought they were. I mean, they're involved in something, but and that was a big shocker to me. It really was.
Yeah, that was one of those left turns you're talking about.
Yeah,
but we shouldn't say too much about it.
No.
Well, no, I can't. But it wasn't as much of a left turn as you would think. I'll tell you why. How many times have you heard someone say, "Why did Bambi's mom have to die?" Or what's with the parent? And I'll be here today to tell you why. Because when you're writing a story about young people, you want them to have the adventure. You don't want them to be bailed out by adults. The show Are You Afraid of the Dark before, we did 91 episodes of Are You Afraid of the Dark. We got rid of the parents 91 times.
Whoa. You mean like,
well, in different ways.
Okay. You didn't kill them all off.
No, we didn't. No, we didn't kill them all. Did we ever kill? I don't think we ever killed. Well, we probably did. I mean, it could be something as simple as, we're going to the movies.
Oh, right.
Just to get them out of the picture. Because one of the themes that are just through all my writing, whether it was television or books, is it's the concept of self-empowerment. So I want to put a young person into a situation where they're in trouble. You know, they're reaching a point of conflict, and it's like, what do I do? Okay, first thing I do is I look for help, and who do I go to? I go to my parents. Why take the parents out of the equation?
Yeah.
Okay, can't go there. Well, I'll go to the police. Well, the police may be in on it too. Okay, I go to the military. Well, the military's running this show. It's like, oh my God. So I'm constantly closing doors in their face for help until they finally realize that there's only one person that can help me, and that's me. Mm-hmm. And that's when they finally rise to the occasion to kind of take charge and control their own destiny. And I do that with all of my writing, and Silo is definitely no different.
Well, I thought it was very touching the way the protagonist felt for his friend Quinn, who was antagonizing him at first, but then he got so he was, you know, really there with him through the whole thing, and then yeah, that was good. That was very good.
Well, those two guys are kind of different sides of the same coin,
mm-hmm.
where Quinn is just, he's a bright kid. Maybe he's too bright for his own good. And he's very insightful, and he sees all these flaws in Tucker, and he's not ashamed to point them out.
Right.
Come on, let's go. But as Tucker says, that's what makes Quinn Quinn. He likes to push people's buttons and get a rise out of people. So they're kind of like a good kind of Greek chorus to each other and needling each other as the story goes on.
So if Tucker is your slacker side, is Quinn your geeky side?
Well, I like to think that I'm more sarcastic and knowing than Tucker is. A character like Quinn is one of the most fun kinds of characters to write because he always has something to say about everything. Often he's one step ahead of the person he's talking about. So the person he's talking about doesn't even realize he's being talked about. And I do that too.
Now, do you have children?
Yes, I do. I have a 10-year-old daughter.
Okay, so is she old enough to read your books yet?
Well, I'm glad you asked that because up until recently, it probably because of her age, but she has shown less than any interest in anything I've ever done. She doesn't want to watch the TV shows, maybe because they're too scary or whatever. She has no interest in watching Flight 29 Down. She has not wanted to read my books.
Mm.
But then this past year, she was in fourth grade this past year, and I went to her classroom to do a book talk on Silo. And I read the first chapter, and everyone in the class is like, especially the boys, they're all like, oh, that sounds great, oh my God. And I donated a couple of books to the library, so the boys are like running over themselves to get to the library first to get the book out. And so that night, my daughter said to me, so, Dad, I think I can have a copy of Silo?
Oh, yeah.
But I knew where she was coming from, because I could be Quinn, too. I said, why? She goes, well, I want to read it. I said, you mean you don't want to walk around school and show off the fact that you've got it? Before it was published. She's like, no. I said, okay, I'll make you a deal. I'll give you a copy of the book, but you can't bring it to school. And so she gave me the kind of eye-rolling look like, Dad.
Mm.
Her credit, and this is the best part, to her credit, I gave her the book, and she read it. And it was the first book of this length that she's ever read, and it was mine.
Aww.
That's a great feeling. And by the way, I have an addendum to this story. So she's been bugging me for the second book.
Yeah, I'll bet.
Oh,
I'll bet, yeah.
When can I read it? I said, not yet. Well, just the other day, I got in a delivery of the advanced reader copies of the second book called Storm. And I said to her, I have a big surprise for you. I had it behind my back. And she said, what is it? And I said, it's something you've been asking me for a long time. She said, is it a bird? No. Is it a Crayola crayon-making set? No. She went through like four things. Finally, she said, is it the second Silo book? I'm like, yes, finally, you guessed it. There you go. And
so
I said to her, you are going to be the first kid in the world to read this book. So she liked that.
As you're telling this story, I'm remembering a scene in a movie. And I think it was The Devil Wears Prada, where she insists that her assistant gets a copy of this book for her twin daughters that want to read it before it's released, and it's like really, really hard to do. I'm not sure if it was that movie, but it was something like that. Do you remember that?
I didn't see that movie, but I can imagine getting those advanced reader copies, especially with kids, because kids, they love being first, love being able to say, I did this before you did this, I've got one up on you and whatnot. And I love that some kids love the fact that I've read this book before you.
Yeah.
That's a good one to to lord over other kids.
Well, it certainly shows that she's not spoiled if it took her four things.
Yeah, I don't give her everything she wants. Though she is going to the One Direction concert tonight, against my better judgment. But yeah.
Oh, okay.
Well, I don't have kids that age, so I don't even know who that is.
No, me neither.
If you'd said it 30 years ago, not 30 years ago, 20-some years ago, and it was Boys to Men, I would have been right, you know, my daughter would have been right there.
You're in the same ballpark.
So, actually, I should remind our listeners that this is Writers' Voices.
Yes.
And we're speaking today with DJ McHale, the author of Silo, the first in a trilogy, and many other books previous to this one. And I'd really, when you started the Pendragon series, you said there was 10 books in that series. Did you have any idea you'd be writing 10 books?
Well, yes. In fact, I outlined all 10 books in about a week.
Oh, my goodness.
It's not as impressive as it sounds.
Well, it sounds
It was very impressive.
Impressive.
And it's because one of the ways I came up with Pendragon was that I had a number of stories that I wanted to write, and I couldn't decide which one to write, so I wrote them all.
Wow.
So I had a number of stories in my head already, and I just kind of tied them all together with this overarching story about Bobby Pendragon, the travelers, and battling St. Dane and all that. So it wasn't like I started from scratch and said, I think I'll write 10 books, and then outline 10 books. It wasn't quite that easy. But yeah, I outlined all 10, and I knew where that was going to end when it started, and I held pretty close to it, too.
Wow. And what years were those published?
The first Pendragon book came out in 2002, the last one in 2009. So it hasn't been that long since the last one came out. And they're still big bestsellers. It's great. It's I think, you know, I look back on my career, which hopefully isn't anywhere close to over, but those kind of big milestone, memorable moments, one of them is it's when they write my obituary, it'll always be, writer of the best-selling series, Pendragon. That's always going to be there. and that's okay. I'm proud of that.
And did that come? Did Morpheus Road come after that or before that?
Yes, it came after that.
It came after that. So after you wrote the Pendragon series, I'm assuming that you had quite a following for that. Were people disappointed that you didn't continue writing more?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Not a day goes by that I don't get an email from someone saying, will there be an 11th Pendragon book?
And?
I'll never say never to anything, but the way that story progressed and finished, there really was a very distinct climax. Unlike those cliffhangers we talked about before, there was a very, very distinct ending. Now, I will say this is a bit of a tease. The Morpheus Road series, which is in some ways very different from Pendragon. It's a trilogy, and it's a supernatural story. It's a ghost story. There is a real mythological link to Pendragon. In fact, I even brought back a major Pendragon character in that series.
Mm.
It doesn't show up until the third book. So it was really great. I wrote the chapter where this character was revealed, and I wrote it, and I teed it all up, and then I paid it all off, and I thought, you know, if the reader of this book hasn't read Pendragon, they're going to just be like, "What? What's the big deal? You know, did I miss something here? Why should this be so exciting?" But for those who have read Pendragon, they get to that chapter and it's just like their brain explodes. They're like, "Oh my God, this guy's in it too." So I could argue that there is an 11th Pendragon book.
Okay.
And it even though Bobby Pendragon is not that character, it does come out in Morpheus Road.
Do you do readers sometimes come to you in Morpheus Road and then go back and read Pendragon? And do you think that'll happen? They'll start with Silo and then maybe go back and read the others?
Absolutely, and yeah. And I think it speaks of age too. I'd say my books are really for all ages. If you ask me who reads my books, I'd say it starts with really 10-year-olds who are really good readers. But the kind of the majority of the readers are like that 11, 12, 13, 14-year-old up to YA. And then skip over everyone who's on a date. unless they're real fans of kind of this kind of literature, and then pick up their parents again.
Okay.
Oh, because, you know, adults read my books all the time. So I think that what happens is, because my books are marketed towards a younger audience, now there's a bunch of silo marketing out there.
Right.
That's what, so the next 12, 13-year-old who never heard of Pendragon hears about silo, and then they're like, oh, wait a minute, have you written something else? Oh, I'm going to go back and read that. And that's one of the beauties of children's literature, is that it goes on forever.
Well, you have a new audience every few years.
Absolutely. I remember I had a discussion with my publicist at the publishing company when The Merchant of Death, the first Pendragon book came out. And she said, DJ, she said, don't look at sales. She said, this is not like some adult bestseller that's going to be on the shelf for 2 weeks, sell a whole bunch of copies, and then go away and you've never heard of it again. She said, this is going to be on shelves for years to come. You have to look at the big picture. And she was absolutely correct. The Merchant of Death, which she said was published in 2002, we sell hundreds of copies every week of that thing. And we're easing up towards 1 million copies of that book.
Wow.
Over the course of the 10 years that it's been out. So again, as you say, it is the beauty of children's literature. There's always a constantly regenerating audience that finds your work.
Well, DJ, I'm really curious about how you came to write the Pendragon books to begin with. You were working in TV. It seems like the career path tends to go the other way. Writers, you know, write a book and then go work and want to be screenwriters. You don't really hear that much of people coming the other way. What pulled you into writing books?
Well, actually, I have an answer, and then you just said something that I want to say something else, too, is that lately it's gone the other way.
Mm.
And part of that is because of the explosion of middle grade and young adult literature, where I know a number of people who have been screenwriters who have enjoyed the freedom and the creativity that's available in writing for books, or writing books. And that's kind of what happened to me. I didn't plan on writing books. That wasn't part of the career path. I was a TV guy. I was making shows for kids. But something happened. You know, it wasn't a distinct moment, but maybe in the late 90s, where kids' television has changed.
Oh, my.
When I say kids, I don't mean for little kids, for tots. I mean for my audience, for that tween kind of audience, young teen audience, where going back to the 70s, 80s, and 90s, there was such a variety of programming on television for kids. I got my start doing ABC after-school specials.
Mm.
I don't know if you remember those.
I do, because I had kids that watched those back in those years.
They were great. I mean, they were kind of maligned over the years because a lot of them were so earnest and forthright. But
right.
Dramas for kids. And they dealt with kids going through real issues. They weren't comedies. The first one that I wrote was dealt with the separation of church and state. It
wow.
was an interfaith high school couple. The girl's Jewish, the guy was Christian, and it took place between Thanksgiving and Christmas, and it was about the issue of, should there be a nativity scene placed on public property?
Mm.
And it was based on a very real incident that happened in my hometown in Connecticut. So it was those kinds of stories for kids, about kids, that could have kids kind of experience real life, not as a comedy. And those shows don't exist anymore. Those are the kinds of shows that I wrote. Even Are You Afraid of the Dark? They were dramas. My show Flight 29 Down, about kids who were marooned on a tropical island, it was a drama. It was when I was developing a new show for Nickelodeon, it was actually going to be the spooky show that was going to replace Are You Afraid of the Dark, that I saw the writing on the wall, is that they were not making shows like that anymore. Here I'm developing the show, but this show is never going to get on the air. And so as I'm working on the show, I'm thinking, yikes, the kinds of things that I write aren't being produced anymore for television, for kids' television.
What are they making for kids now?
I'm sorry?
What do they air for kids now? I don't...
Sitcoms.
Oh.
That's the simple answer. I mean, there's a lot out there, but it's sitcoms. And I see that through my daughter's eyes.
Mm.
Between Disney and Nickelodeon, it's the same show, just with different characters.
Kind of the Saved by the Bell type?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, very much a Saved by the Bell.
Yeah.
But imagine Imagine a network doing nothing but Saved by the Bell.
Oh, Lord.
No, there's nothing wrong with Saved by the Bell.
No.
And there's nothing wrong with a lot of those comedies. What I think is wrong with it is there's nothing but that.
Oh.
And it's certainly in live action. I mean, the animation, there's a lot of different things. But in live action, it's the same. And I think the reason for it is that they're less expensive to produce. And kids do like comedies. There's nothing, you know, there's nothing wrong with comedies. But I'll give you an example. When my show, Are You Afraid of the Dark, first was on the air, it started in 1992, Nickelodeon, some genius at Nickelodeon, I don't know who it was, they came up with, and I mean that seriously, they realized that on Saturday nights, there is a group of people out there who are too old to be in bed and too young to be on a date.
Mm-hmm.
And they're watching television. And traditionally, Saturday night is the Death Valley of television, where nobody watches, but these kids are watching. So they created something called SNICK, Saturday Night Nick. It went from 8 p.m. until 10 p.m., and there were four half-hour shows. And in that half an hour, the first show was a sitcom, the second show was a comedy variety show, the third show was an irreverent animated show, and the fourth show was my show, Are You Afraid of the Dark, a drama. Mm-hmm. So in that two-hour span, kids were exposed to all sorts of different shows. There was a little bit for everybody. Now you don't get that. Now it's just, it's sitcom 24/7. And I think that, and as a father, I'm really upset by that, because I want my daughter to be exposed to more things, but they're drawn to the cheap, easy laugh.
Yeah.
So that's what kind of pushed me out of kids' television and into writing the kinds of dramas, the adventure stories.
Now, you could have made the switch into sitcom writing and producing, I assume.
No, I'm not a comedy writer. It takes a certain animal to write comedies. There's humor in my writing. But
right.
A joke, not three jokes on a page.
Right.
With a big laugh track when the thing really isn't that funny to begin with. I watch these shows and I'm just rolling my eyes saying, really? This is what we've come to? So that kind of pushed me into books. And it didn't push me. I sought out books, and it's been great. So I have no complaints.
Well, now you mentioned that children's literature, young adult and teen, middle age reading books have really exploded. Do you think that maybe it's partially because there's a drought of good material on TV, and so the kids who are looking for that go to books?
Oh, that's interesting. I know I hadn't thought of it that way. The one thing I will say is that you know, people are always so quick to be down on kids. Oh, those darn kids today, they're just playing video games and on the computer and all that. Well, I travel all over the country, and I go to schools, and I'm at bookstores, and I meet a lot of kids who are really smart, who are really good readers, who are very well-read. And that speaks to what you just said, that sure, they're looking for something that has a little more meat to it, a little more substance to it than they're going to get with a lot of kids' television. And I don't mean to denigrate all kids' television, but if you're a little bit more thoughtful, you're going to find something in books. And I will say, I think we all owe a huge debt of gratitude to J.K. Rowling's with Harry Potter.
Mm-hmm.
Because prior to Harry Potter, the majority of books written for young people were very slight works. They're very thin. You know, slight paperbacks.
Right.
Short stories. Again, not that there's anything wrong with them, but that's all there was.
Right.
And when I first wrote The Merchant of Death, which is the first Pendragon book, I turned it into my agent, and he freaked out. He's like, what did you do? I said, well, what do you mean? He said, this is too long. Like, what are you talking about? He goes, the publisher's going to reject this. I said, but this is what I said I was going to do. Like, but that, I mean, I didn't know. I wasn't in publishing before. I just wrote a book. And he said, they're going to reject this because they thought, you know, they wanted like a little 40,000 word thing. I'm like, but that's not what I said. So we actually came up with a plan. And we said, if the publisher rejects this as being too long, we're going to say, oh, no, you're mistaken. This is actually three books.
There you go.
And we're going to have three books. Fortunately, the publishers were already ahead of the game. They knew, based on Harry Potter, they knew that kids had more going on than what they had been given credit for. And that led to the explosion of all the books we just talked about, of young adult and middle reader books that have more substance than the kind of short paperbacks.
When did the first Harry Potter book come out?
I don't know. I'm maybe 1990, 98, maybe 99, somewhere around there.
Okay, so you were familiar with that. You were aware of that already when you started writing.
Aware is the best word.
Aware, yeah.
I mean, I knew that it was a growing phenomenon, and I deliberately did not read it because I did not want to be influenced.
Right.
In it at all. As it turns out, the Harry Potter had nothing to do with what I was writing, but I didn't even want to be subliminally influenced.
Mm-hmm.
Because on the off chance that what I was writing was similar to Harry Potter, and if I got called out for that, I wanted to righteously be able to say, but I never read it, so I didn't know. It's a total coincidence.
Yeah, yeah.
But to this day, I have not read Harry Potter.
Really?
Yeah, I started, going back to my daughter being the selective reader, I tried to get my daughter interested, and so I started reading it to her, and I kind of liked it. I was like, wow, this is kind of fun. But then she never got into it, so we never went beyond the first two or three chapters.
Okay. Now, some of the other books that have really kind of been huge publishing successes over the recent years are also aimed at young adults. I'm thinking Hunger Games, and then the most recent, the Divergent series. They're maybe a little older than your books. I'm thinking, you know, the audience they're written to is perhaps a little bit older.
Yeah, I think so. My books kind of straddle the line between middle grade and young adult. And I can tell you the difference between the two. With a young adult book, someone dies, and the protagonist goes through a horrible life-changing experience because of it. They angst over it. Maybe they'll do drugs. Maybe they'll act out. Maybe they'll do bad in school. All this kind of horrible angsting over this person's death. In a middle grade book, an entire world is destroyed, and the protagonist says, "Oh, that's too bad. Okay, moving on." And mine kind of go back and forth. I destroy worlds, but then the character angsts over it.
Oh God! It sounds like you really enjoy writing. Enjoy creating. That's wonderful.
Well, the thing is, I don't write for that audience. That's the main thing. I write for myself. I just try to write a fun story, and it just so happens that my voice and the kinds of stories that I come up with speak to that audience. So it's not like I'm trying.
So when you were saying that your agent was afraid the publisher would reject the Merchant of Death, were you able to sell the series before you had written it?
Yeah, well, that's actually funny. You know, every author has their own story about, you know, how did you get your first book published?
Right.
And I have a good one, but it's not a traditional one, and it's kind of what we were saying before. I sometimes when I speak to book groups or adult authors and whatnot, I give a very kind of tongue-in-cheek presentation about I'm going to now go through the steps to teach you how to get your book published, because I'm going to explain how I got my book published. Step one, create a hit television series.
That helps.
That's just do that. Go and do that. Yeah. No problem. Then make sure there's a book spin-off series made from that television series.
Ah.
Help the publishing company work with it to create those books. Because then, a couple of years later, when you come up with your own book series, you can go back to that editor and say, "Hey, remember me? Remember we worked together on that series?" And they will publish your book. So, so looking at it one way, it was incredibly easy to get Pendragon published. On the other hand, all the work came in for the years and the decades before that, where I put in all the blood, sweat, and tears of building up a TV career in order to get known as a television writer and someone who writes for kids. So it was there wasn't a huge chance that they took. And I should say, when I made the first deal, I said, "I want to write this 10-book series." They said, "Okay, we'll buy 4 books."
Ah.
I was disappointed at first, but then I thought, no, this is good.
Yes.
Because if it's not working after 4 books, I'm not going to want to do it anymore anyway.
Right.
But if it is working, then I've got leverage.
Right, because you haven't already set the price on the rest of them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that worked out really well.
Ah,
good.
Very good. Well, DJ, why don't you read a section of Silo to us today?
Oh, sure, I'd love to. One of the things that I've learned in starting with TV and then with books is that we live in a new age now. I'm going to sound like an old guy. We live in a new age where you've got to grab your reader or your viewer instantly, because if you don't, they're going to move on. And it all goes back to, I blame the television remote control. That's where it all started.
You're right. But, you're right.
I mean, remember those days not that long ago where you actually had to stand up and walk over to the television and twist the dial to move to the next channel?
Absolutely.
And because you had to do that, you thought twice before you did it.
That's right.
Well, that we don't have that anymore. And with, I mean, it even comes down to e-books, where you could get a sample on an e-book. If you don't like it, you're hitting that button. It's just like, nah, now it's not working for me. Boom, you're gone. The librarian at my daughter's school gave me some great advice once, as a dad, not as an author. She said that if there's a reluctant reader, ask them, you want them to try a book, just suggest to them, say, just read your age.
Mm.
You're 12 years old, read 12 pages. If you're 8 years old, read 8 pages. Chances are, if after that time, if you're not going to like the book, you'll know it. But if you are going to like the book, you'll know it as well.
Right.
So as an author, it means that you've got to... I once read a review of one of my books written by a young guy. He's on one of those Amazon-type things. And I've always remembered it because he wrote the review, "This book was really slow to get started." And I thought, oh, this is going to be bad. Comma. "But after the first 10 pages, it really took off." Like, oh my God, it's a book. It's not a video game. It's a book. Come on. But that's the reality.
No, it's true. I mean, you're lucky he gave you 10 pages.
I know, really. He kept going. So I tried. So what I'll do right now, I'll read the first chapter of Silo, and it's only, let me see how many pages. It's only 6 pages.
Mm.
It's only 5.5 pages. But what I hope to do in those 5-6 pages is to make it intriguing enough that the reader will want to turn the next page. And in fact, when I turned in the first draft to my editor, because usually what happens is you kind of start with an intriguing thing, and then hopefully you've grabbed your reader. You can then kind of downshift a little bit and get to learn about the characters and get to know the characters. Well, my editor said, you know, TJ, the real big stuff doesn't really start happening until page 50. Maybe you need something else besides that first. So I actually wrote a second chapter where a big thing happened, which is great advice. I'm glad I did it, but it's come to that. So let me read the first chapter. And I should say that no huge things happen in this chapter, but it's intriguing enough that hopefully it'll get readers to want to read the 7th page.
Oh, I think that's a pretty big thing that happens.
well, it is a big thing, but it barely foreshadows the really big things that are going to come.
That is true.
Right, true.
So I guess I get the best of both worlds. I get to really start small in a big way.
Yes, yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay, you ready?
Yeah.
Chapter 1. Oh, and by the way, it also comes down to your first line, your first 2 lines, as to whether someone's going to keep reading or not.
Yeah, this one grabs you.
Chapter 1. "It was the perfect night for a football game and for death." So there are my 2 first lines. Hopefully that's going to make someone keep reading.
I would think so.
"It was the perfect night for a football game and for death. Not that the two have anything in common. When you hear the term sudden death, you normally don't expect there to be an actual loss of life, sudden or otherwise. But there was nothing normal about that night. It was the night it began. The night of the death. The first death. I was sitting on the end of the team bench, more interested in the cheerleaders than the game. To be honest, I didn't have much business being on the team. There weren't many freshmen on the Arbortown High varsity. But with a student population that barely squeaked past 200, if you had 2 legs and didn't mind being brutally punished by guys who were older, bigger, and faster than you, you were in. I'm not exactly sure why I accepted the role of living tackling dummy, but I liked football and figured that in a few years I'd be the one running over hapless freshmen. So I guess I was paying my dues. My main duty during a game was to be the sprinter on the kickoff team. That meant I had to run directly for the guy who fielded the kick, which made me the first guy to get taken out by the wall of blockers who were intent on stopping that very thing. It was an ugly job, but at least it meant I'd come out of a game with a little dirt on my uniform. My other duty was to be the backup for our senior tailback, Marty Wiggins. That's why I spent most of my time on the bench watching the cheerleaders. Marty was a legend. He'd had big-time colleges sniffing around him since he was a sophomore. He was that good. But on that night, he was just sick. The stands were packed. For Arbortown High, that meant maybe 500 people. It wasn't exactly the Rose Bowl, but you wouldn't know that from the excitement Marty was generating. The place went nuts every time he got his hands on the ball because he was running over guys and knocking them aside like bowling pins. When he was tackled, which wasn't often, he took three players to drag him down. It was like watching a pro beating up on Pop Warner boys. He was in for most every play of the game. With only a few minutes left, he dropped down next to me on the bench to take a rare breather. He sat there gulping air, staring back at the field. I figured his night was over, so I held up my fist for a knuckle bump and said, "Dude, awesome." Marty looked at me, and I froze. He had a fiery, wild look in his eyes that made me think for one terrifying moment that he was going to hit me. The guy was totally charged up with, what, excitement? Anger? Insanity? He didn't bump knuckles. Just as well. He might have broken my hand. I sat there like a fool with my fist hovering, unbumped. I didn't want to say anything else for fear he'd drive his helmet through my face. Instead, he grabbed my forearm in a grip that was so fierce I had black and blue marks the next day. "What's happening?" he whispered through gasping breaths. He said it with a disturbing mix of fear and confusion that made me believe he truly didn't understand what was going on around him or with him. "What do you mean?" I asked tentatively. "Wiggins!" barked Coach. Marty jumped to his feet and sprinted back into the game as if he had been launched from a catapult. I was left on the bench, not knowing what had just happened. The play was called, and the team went to the line. Marty was pitched the ball, and he rumbled around left end for another 15 yards. All was well. Marty was fine. I chalked up his odd behavior to adrenaline and the excitement of the game and went back to my all-important cheerleader review. Arbortown is a pretty small place, so going to a high school football game was the best thing to do on Friday nights in the fall. Okay, the only thing to do. As I scanned the crowd, I saw many people I knew, including my mother and father. Dad gave me a big smile and a thumbs up. Mom wasn't as enthusiastic. She hated that I played football. Her deep frown meant she was expecting me to get injured just by sitting on the bench. I gave them a small wave and looked away, to notice a strange face in the crowd. It belonged to a man with longish blonde hair wearing a hoodie. He looked like a surfer dude, complete with beard stubble and a single earring. He stood out amid the sea of fans because he was the only one not cheering. Instead, he wrote furiously in a small notebook. I figured he might have been a college scout. It would explain why Marty was playing like he was possessed. This could be a scholarship showcase for him. "Button up," Coach ordered as he strode past. "We're going to score again." That meant all the wretched scrubs, like me, had to be ready for another kickoff. We were on the 10-yard line and about to go in. There were only a few seconds left in the game, and I was surprised that, seeing it was a blowout, Coach hadn't pulled Marty. Maybe he knew there was a scout in the crowd taking notes. Or maybe he didn't trust Marty's backup, me. I stood up with the rest of the team and cheered for the offense. It felt cheesy to be screaming for another score since the game had already been over since halftime, but what can you do? It's football. The team came up to the line, the QB called signals, and the ball was snapped. Marty took the handoff, no big surprise, and blasted into the line off right tackle. The defense had had enough. They didn't want any part of him. There were a few half-hearted arm tackles that didn't slow him down as he burst into the end zone. Touchdown. The crowd exploded once again, cheering ecstatically while the band kicked in with our fight song, Jericho. The cheerleaders jumped around and hugged each other like we just won a championship and all we'd done was add pad to an already lopsided score. Marty sprinted to the back of the end zone, turned to the stands, threw his arms up in triumph, and dropped dead. Of course, I didn't know that at the time. All I saw was Marty fall over and land on his back. First, I thought it was some new kind of celebration dance, like spiking himself instead of the ball. Our players were jumping on each other, chest bumping and high-fiving. When they finally got around to focusing on the guy who was the cause of the celebration, they pulled on his arms to help him up, but Marty didn't respond. In seconds, the emotion of the moment flipped from elation to concern. "Hey," our guys yelled while waving to the sideline for help. "He's hurt." The crowd noise died instantly. It was a rude jolt to experience the sudden and dramatic change from joyous cheers and music to absolute silence. Coach sprinted onto the field, waving at the other players to back away. He was quickly joined by a paramedic. With the rest of our offense huddled nearby, watching expectantly, the paramedic knelt down next to Marty to examine him. There was no doubt in anyone's mind that something serious had happened to our superstar. As he lay still on the grass, two more paramedics ran out to the field with a fracture board. I turned around to look at my parents. Dad's expression now matched Mom's. They knew something horrible had happened. Everyone knew. A few seconds later, we heard the urgent scream of a far-off siren. I didn't look back to the field right away because I was mesmerized by the communal look of anxiety and horror on the faces of each and every person in the stands. All eyes were on the end zone and the guy who lay on his back, not moving. People cleared a path for Marty's dad, who pushed his way through to get to the field. the poor guy was about to find out that his son had just gone from playing the game of his life to taking the final breath of his life. Every last person feared that they were witnessing something horrific, something they would never forget. Nobody moved as they waited for the news they knew wouldn't be good. Almost nobody, that is. As I stared at the stands, I noticed that one person had already left. He hadn't even stuck around long enough for the ambulance to arrive. The surfer dude with the notebook was gone. It was the night of the death, the first death, and it was only the beginning. So that's the that's the first chapter of Silo, and I have to say, this is not a football story. This is not a murder mystery. Where the story goes from here is very unexpected.
Yeah. Right.
But that's what I like to do. I like to lead you down that path and then take a turn, and turns are about to come fast and furious.
Well, you know, your immediate reaction, mine was, well, this young man is obviously taken something to enhance his prowess, and it's been his downfall. And, of course, that's very big in the news these days, is the athletes that are taking, you know, enhancing drugs. And so it's just one of those, it's one of the things that make your books probably so successful, is because you incorporate things that are going on.
Well, that's absolutely right. And I was a little nervous about that because, I mean, a little bit of a spoiler alert, that's kind of what it is. And sometimes I get nervous about, can I go to that kind of story with a young book? And the answer is yes. I'm not telling a morality tale, but I am telling the truth. And, again, it's not a story about taking steroids, but that's kind of one of the elements in it, and I have characters that are often faced with difficult decisions, and the answers aren't always obvious.
Right.
And there's, you know, there's in life there's very little black and white. There's a whole lot of gray in between. So I have characters that make choices that seem like the right choice, and maybe it is the right choice, but there are often repercussions that come from that choice, and that's real life as well too. And you're right. That's what I like to do with my stories, is to have real life consequences for making real life decisions, even though the surrounding elements are bigger than life and fantastical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, to me, that made, you know, it made it more realistic. It really grabbed my attention because I thought, okay, now what's going to happen?
Now, DJ, when you talk about how you like to put little twists in your plot, I'm thinking that you were inspired to do that by some other writers that came before you.
Well, that's absolutely true. I mentioned before about how, you know, prior to Harry Potter, certainly fiction for middle grade and young adults existed, but not to the extent that it does today. And my standard joke that I always give is that when I was a kid, I went from Dr. Seuss straight to Dr. No,
mm-hmm.
which was kiddie books to James Bond.
Right.
And because there certainly were books that existed in between there, but
right.
I loved the action and adventure. My two favorite authors growing up, when I say growing up, I mean at the age when I would be reading my books,
right,
were Ian Fleming, who wrote the James Bond books, and Alistair MacLean, who wrote many, many adventure novels. And Alistair MacLean always wrote character-driven adventures, and Ian Fleming always wrote stories that were larger than life with very creative villains with amazing plots. So I like to think that Silo is kind of a mix of those two styles put together. It's a bigger-than-life story, but it's also about characters that we can relate to that go on these adventures.
And is Alfred Hitchcock another one of your sort of inspirations?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, my gosh. I used to say that Are You Afraid of the Dark was Hitchcock 101. Because one of the things that Alfred Hitchcock did so well was he implied things. He didn't necessarily show you everything. What he knew was that what makes you tense, what makes your palms sweat, is what you think might happen as much as what happens. Mm. And I remember once reading an interview with him, and he described a scene, and he said, okay, he was talking about movies now, of course. He said, imagine a scene where there are two people eating lunch in an outdoor cafe. Zoom in on them, and a bomb goes off under their table. So, of course, everyone jumps, and it's frightening, and you're, oh, my God, that was scary, oh, my gosh. He says, but then it's over. Now imagine that scene a different way. Imagine two people eating lunch at an outdoor cafe. We reveal to the audience that there's a ticking bomb under that table. And then we let them talk about the weather for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
They're sitting there going, you know that bomb's going to go off. You know it's going to happen. You just don't know when it's going to happen. And by the time it goes off, the bomb going off is almost a relief when it finally goes off. So I found that in my writing, I try not to just go from event to event, action sequence to event. It's like I like to hold back on it. So oftentimes when I'll have a big event going on, I'll go back into a story and I'll add lines to slow the pace down.
Mm-hmm. Just
to hold you back a little bit because you know where it's going, and so you start reading faster to get through to say, we got to get there. And then, by
yeah.
the time it happens, then it's a real big payoff. So, and that's Hitchcock 101. So even though from his point of view, as a movie point of view, I like to try to incorporate it in my writing to get readers to wonder what's going to happen. That's as much fun as finding out what is happening, and that's throughout my books.
Now, DJ, it seems to me that Silo would make a great movie. Are there any talks in the work about that, in the works?
Well, there's more than talks.
Ah.
Uh-huh. Okay.
We are seconds away from making an announcement.
Whoa!
announcement hasn't been made yet. It's because all the deals haven't been done.
Yeah.
And so, without mentioning any specific names, I did this the right way. I went out with my management company, and we found a terrific producer who's made a million great movies like this. We found a director who is working in the genre, in fact, has a big movie out right now. We went to the writer who wrote that big movie right now. So we got all these elements together, and we went back to the studio that put out that movie that's out right now and said, what do you think? And they said, yeah, this looks pretty good. This could be your next movie. Mm-hmm. So, but we can't make an announcement until all those people I just mentioned, they all have to get their deals done. We're waiting on one last deal to be done.
Okay.
If all deals don't get done, it all goes away.
Oh.
And frankly, with movies, it can all go away at any second anyway. So this is a long way away from coming soon to a theater near you. So hopefully that last deal will get done, and then the next step is that writer will write the screenplay. And if that's good and the budget's right, then hopefully we'll be able to make a movie. So absolutely. We're beyond the talks. We're into the practicality. But I can't say anything.
Well, I'm going to congratulate you anyway.
I've been in this business long enough to take the victories where you can get them.
Absolutely.
Because they always fall. Nine times out of ten, things fall through. So I used to not talk about anything until it was actually on the screen. But now I'm like, you know, this is good. The studio wants to make this movie. Let's talk about it.
And DJ, when does book two of Silo come out?
In March of next year.
Wow.
It's called Storm.
So long. We have to wait so long.
Well, that's not that long. The Pendragons took a year to come out in between. This
wow.
is 9 months. It'll be
All
nine
right.
months before Storm comes out, and I believe the last one will be out, which I'm writing right now, 9 months after that.
Wow.
I encourage listeners to go to my website, djmikhailbooks.com. I have a very active forum on that website where readers go in and they talk about all my books and they give their theories, and it's happening with Silo right now. You know, who is Silo? Who are the good guys? Who are the bad guys? So if you're really into it and you want to talk about the books, do that. And you
right.
can also find me on Twitter and Facebook, and I answer all of my emails.
Well, thank you, and thank you so much for being with us today. We are flat out of time. This was a really fun conversation, and I learned a lot about the business, the young adult.
Yeah.
Publishing business that
and
I didn't know before.
It's a great book. It really
and,
is.
And look forward to book two.
Thank you. It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right. And Caroline, you got some parting words of wisdom for us today?
Yeah, I do. This, never bear more than one trouble at a time. Some people bear three kinds: all that they have had, all that they have now, and all that they expect to have. And that's very foolish.
Stay tuned now for Planet Earthswild with the ever wonderful James Moore, and see you next week on Writer's Voices. Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, produced by Monica Hadley and James Moore. Archives available on KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com.